ॐ ज्ञानचन्द्रनन्दस्य ज्ञानञ्जनशलाकय भक्तिवृन्दवृतं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः. श्रीचैतन्यमनोभीष्टं स्थापितं येन भूतले स्वयं रूपा कृदा मायम् ददाति सापदन्तिकम् वैराग्ययुग्भक्तिवशं प्रयत्नाय अभयं मामनभिप्समन्दं कृपं भूया फलधूकदूकी सनातनस्थं प्रभुमाश्रयामि. पञ्चकौपातरुभ्यश्च कृपा सिन्धुभये च पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः. श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द द्वैत गदाधर शिवासादि घोर भक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 रामो हरे रामो राम राम हरे हरे. सो ग्रीटिंग्स फ्रॉम वेस्ट विलेज. I'm walking along the Hudson River. I stayed last night with Raghunath. He has an apartment, I guess, near the Hudson. A member of Sadhu in Vrindavan told me, he said, if in your I don't know how he knew the Hudson, but he said, maybe he didn't even mention the Hudson, but maybe it was just the river. He said, if you're in New York and you see the Hudson River and you think of the Jamuna and offer your prayers to the Jamuna, then the Jamuna in New York, the Jamuna in Vrindavan will take your prayers. That's called Udipan. Impetus, after all, we're not separated from God by a physical distance. It's a different dimension. We're separated from consciousness, and that's what we've been reading in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita with Narada Muni, how in his search for the topmost devotee, he has to see Uddhava in Dwarka, and because Uddhava is the Parishad, or the very close associate of Krishna, seeing Uddhava means seeing Krishna. And that's actually the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, that seeing the devotee is seeing Krishna. Because the devotee is looking at Krishna, just like that Back to Godhead mass. You know, Prabhupada is looking at Krishna. Even in the Bhagavatam, sometimes says, now I'll tell you about Krishna. And then they narrate a story about a devotee. Because that's what devotee means. Devotee means lover of Krishna. So Krishna is in the devotee's heart. Krishna is in the devotee's vision. And therefore, when we associate with the devotee, we get Krishna. And that's the topmost, secret given by Uddhava to Krishna. Topmost secret is the way to Krishna is through the devotees, Because the devotees also have Krishna. Having Krishna means Krishna loves you. And when someone loves you, they follow your desire. When someone loves you, you control that person. Well, you can control that person. You can give that person. So the devotee loves Krishna so much that the devotee wins Krishna's heart, and Krishna loves the devotee. And because Krishna loves the devotee, then that devotee controls Krishna, can give Krishna. So going to Uddhava is being in the proximity of Krishna, and because Narada comes, Krishna is in a deep state of separation from the residents of Vrindavan. So that's where we were in the Srimad Bhagavatamrita, when Uddhava is glorified by Narada Muni as the best devotee. He can only think of the best devotees. And because of personal experience of going to Vrindavan and associating with the residents of Vrindavan who have unparalleled love for Krishna, they have the bhakti in their heart. Bhakti is Krishna's bliss potency. And it's flowing to the highest degree, the highest degree, that potency is running through their hearts. And that's what pleasure is. Pleasure is when real selfless love, spiritual love, not tinged, any cause, anything we want for ourselves, real love, when that love is flowing through one's heart, that energy, it's like a river. It's somehow a river that flows through you. It's like when you take a nectar drink. Last night when I got in very, very late, I got back in very, very late from the 12-hour kirtan. And I was thirsty, and Raghunath, I guess you get anything you want in New York, ice-cold coconut. And I was drinking that coconut water. And as it was coming through my mouth and tongue, it gave me pleasure. But that's pleasure on the sensual platform. Pleasure on the platform of the heart, and the nectar, the juice, the amrit of rasa flows through the heart. That's the highest pleasure. Because that is what pleasure is. Pleasure is the potency of God. It's an existential potency of God, which we're meant to carry in our heart. That's what we're for. We apparently know it, but it gets misdirected in other ways. Anyway, Uddhava is honest. He doesn't have ego. He's ready to embrace the truth. And what he says is, I don't have any devotion. I thought I was a great devotee. When I saw the residents of Vrindavan, whatever pride I had, and he gives the nicest analogy, is crushed to dust. So I think that's where we were at trying to remember a little bit beyond that, because this morning I realized I don't have my book. My book is still in my car. And the way it is in New York, if you find a parking spot, and it was 11 o'clock at night, rather than drive my car, I came another way to stay where I am. So I'm not sure I'd find another parking spot late at night. And therefore, I'll just do a few things today. I'll tell you what I did yesterday. Sometimes that's interesting, hopefully. And then I'll speak on what I'm going to speak on in Croatia. I'll go on Monday to a kirtan retreat with Satchinandana Swami. And, it's his show. I'm not saying that in any way other than, you know, he's a master at this, and he has a particular way of presenting how to get deep into the holy name. And he's been kind enough to give me a few slots, as I am coming my own edification and my own purification. Opportunities like this to get that type of association don't come off, and I should practice what I preach, that the most important thing in our spiritual life is to get good association, good sangha, sangha which can become absorbed in spiritual, in hearing. That's what spiritual life means. It means when the consciousness is focused on the proper thing. I'll explain my day. There's some interesting things in it. So Friday I drove down from New York. I'm staying at Kasuga's on Friday. And there's a famous scholar that was in town. In terms of the yoga world, I mean, two of the main gurus are Iyengar and Bobby Joyce. Both of them had the same guru, and it's considered the kind of the, I don't know, founder or modern yoga, Krishna Namacharya. And so one of his closest, he passed away many years ago, so one of his closest, Patapi Joyce passed away. So one of his closest disciples was in town giving lectures at the Bloom Street Temple where Krishna, where Kasuga has the Radha Damodar deities. That Kasubi says, look, I have to pick him up and bring him to the program. You want to come? And I said, sure. Radhanath Swami was also giving a lecture that night. We picked him up, the apartment he was staying, and he was a pure Brahmin. Really, I mean, him and his wife, to see the level of piety. You can see piety in people's face, their mannerisms, people who are humble, self-satisfied. They're happy right where they are at the moment. And they have no envy in their hearts. They're no sense of violence or aggressiveness or desires. It's really very high souls. Perhaps, you know, well, you see that in India somehow, South Indian Brahmin, you know, even Krishna movement, sometimes you see these people, extraordinary. So we went, we picked them up, and this program at the Bhakti Center was at 6 o'clock, but, you know, we knew that it really wouldn't start the lecture before 7:30. It would be mostly kirtans. And so we decided we picked him up, very nice man, decided we'd stay for the first part of the lecture. And the sound system was absolutely, absolutely horrible. And we were sitting in the back because we told him we had to leave. We wouldn't want to show the, we wouldn't want to show the disrespect of just, you know, getting up in the front. So even though the sound system was bad, and he had an accent that was maybe a little bit difficult to follow, because he was such a scholar, because they're such a scholar and he spoke so nicely in context of everything, I could follow. And actually, one of the first things he did, I forgot the examples he gave, but they were funny and brilliant, about how you should hear everything in context. And he gave a nice example. He said this one bishop or priest visited New York, and I don't know, some reporter came and asked him some kind of question or something. You know, are you coming to New York to visit the brothels? And the priest was so innocent that he said, are there brothels in New York? So then the next day in the paper, they had a headline, you know, priest says, are there brothels in New York? So it just shows you, and I love that example because I always speak like that, that real philosophy is in context. So the first thing he said, in Sankhya, they ask questions, three questions. And if you answer yes to all three, then there's no need. The answer yes to all three, then there's no need to study the Yoga Sutras. So the first question is, as soon as you answer no, you can study the Yoga Sutras. He said the first question is, are there, have you found what you want? If you say no, okay, then study the Yoga Sutras. If you say yes, then you have to see about the other questions. So how have you found what you want? Well, you say yes, then you have to say, is it eternal? Is the object of what you're searching for eternal? Okay, and then if you say no, then you should study the Yoga Sutras. If you say yes, you have to answer the final question. The final question is, you found what you want, and it's eternal. Are you able to focus on it without stop? So if you say yes, then no need to study the Yoga Sutras. So I thought it was actually quite a brilliant. It was just so scholarly. In fact, today maybe I'm going to sneak over there and see if I'm exhausted. So that's what I did Friday. Stayed at Kasubis. Got back late, and it was kind of hectic. It was really hectic the next morning. Because Radhanath Swami invited me to take a walk the length of Central Park. And that meant I had to get my car uptown and then drive downtown to park it for the program. Otherwise, anyway, for reasons. And then go back with them to Central Park and took a long walk. Vigorous walk, something I needed. There were about 15 people. It's always sweet with Maharaj and the devotees in it. At the end of, right at the end of the park, We were, Carl's there, we were thinking of visiting where him and Mal Krishnaraj used to live. But to get back to the beginning, walking the whole park and to get back in time for the kirtan, didn't have time, but at the end of the park, there's a statue of Duke Ellington sitting on a piano. So, I don't know, Ramnath Swami, it was nice at the end. He told a story that, because a lot of the kirtaneers were there, Gauravani and Ananta, and he told a story I don't know who told me. Maybe it was Tamal Krishna, I don't know. But the story about Duke Ellington, that in his band, he had all the greatest musicians in his jazz band, all the greatest musicians, and they all stayed together. And the reason they all stayed together is that he gave as much time and focus and spotlight on them in the performance as he did himself. So I guess it was a nice instruction on really how to be a leader, be a servant leader. He's more concerned with overall effect of what you're doing as an offering. In that sense, maybe aesthetics, in our sense, maybe to God, an overall offering, then the focus and highlight on ourselves. And that's such a nice example of devotional service. That's Trinada Peace and Ichena, Trinada Peace and Ichena. We discussed this before, years ago in my book, that although there's individual performance in kirtan, the individual performance is to enhance the overall effect and not necessarily to highlight oneself. And then on the travel, the what's happening here in New York is just absolutely amazing. I mean, I told you about our little festival last year, 150 yogis came. This one nice guy that when he's 15, he used to go to 26 Second Avenue, a little bit younger than me, and he's a musician and a writer and a music professor. And he comes to all the 12-hour kirtans. Very humble guy. We drove up in the cab. Just started doing some blues on the harmonium. Nice guy. I even love the name of his new band. Those of you in New Yorkers, you'll appreciate it. It's called Trebekistan. And really nice. And well, he was saying also that, because he's teaches different universities music, history, he said that even Duke Ellington, of all the band members, his salary was the least. And that was nice. And then we went down to the kirtan, and it was kind of phenomenal. I mean, again, I mean, incredible kirtaneers. Well, and, you know, 12 hours from 10 to 10, our good friend Shamdas came again and had a little spot, and of course, Radhanath Swami, Gauravani, Ananta, Achyuta, Lakshmi Nishringa, Janavi and Tulsi. Wow, they're good. From the fathers of my godbrother. And, you know, concert violinists coming and different musicians and so many new people just coming through the door. And in fact, I invited one lady. She's studying study, I think, for a PhD, and she came to our festival, and just seeing how the power of kirtan, when it's done in the appropriate way, and how absorbing kirtan can be as a spiritual experience that fixes the mind on the divine. Just to fix the mind is a relief. That works no matter how you fix the mind. When you fix the mind on the divine, which is aptly described in the Yoga Sutras by Professor Bryant, where it's not just a meditational prop, but it's an object of meditation, which you have a relationship with. And to see that effect on people, and it was incredible, actually. And went on till 10:30 at night, and I myself am trying to make whatever arrangement possible to take avail of that type of spiritual purification and absorption. It was really, really nice. And so maybe I can just say a few words or give a little introduction what I'm doing and some questions. And I am going to Croatia, and I do have some presentation. And the presentation I'm preparing is Why Kirtan Gives the Most Bliss. And I'm looking at it from this, just from one point, just from a classical yogic paradigm, that the spiritual life means an absorption. And it, that absorption in all spiritual practices begins with the control of the mind. That's why we worship Madan Mohan. Madan Mohan means the conqueror of lust. It, therefore, it's the desire of Sambandhagyan. And Sambandhagyan begins when one makes the distinction between the soul and the body. That's really when metaphysical understanding begins. Because if you make that basic misconception, it's really hard to understand anything else deeply. So, yoga, spiritual life, begins with the process of detaching the consciousness from the body, whether it's pravritti, satisfying your attachments for that purpose, or renouncing your attachments for that purpose, the goal is the same. So, and just a psychosomatic, a psychosomatic paradigm or perspective, that happens when the mind can become fixed on something, because when the senses are controlled, the super soul is at reach. When you stop taking the external dictation, the voice, the realization, the dwelling in the spiritual, the transcendence begins. So my thesis is that the most powerful way is not the only way, but the most powerful way, especially in this age of distraction. And I think we have to all be honest that, wow, things are not advancing very much. It's advancing in distraction, mostly the world is advancing in distraction. There's more and more ways to get people absorbed in passion and ignorance. That's the shapes and sounds of the world that are being promoted. I'm here in New York City. You know, you can feel it. You don't have to be in New York City. You can be anywhere where there is a high-speed connection and you're being challenged. You're being challenged. So it's a particularly distracting particularly distracting world. And therefore, the hearing process, because the hearing is the most absorbing sense, basically. You know, hearing is so distracting. You can't shut your eyes. I mean, it's there. It comes to you. And in a positive way, if there's good hearing, it's a powerful way to fix the mind. So that's my thesis. It's supported by Sri Jiva Goswami. He says Sankirtan. And Sankirtan here refers to chanting with, you know, music. He says it gives special feelings of bliss. And there was the statement, I wanted more pramana. I wanted more evidence. In my own tradition, of course, that's Jiva Goswami, but through Prabhupada. I just found this very beautiful letter that Prabhupada, he just makes such a simple statement that hearing made easy by music. And we're very attracted by the music. It seems to be almost a universal and powerful samskara or attachment that people have. And therefore, the consciousness, the object of the ears, flows to the object of sound very, very easily, especially when it's sweet and melodic, and, you know, and good music on some type of level, but music in general. So it's really a powerful way to absorb the mind. And when it's combined with mantra, it's particularly effective. It's particularly effective. So that's the basic theory, and there is some support. Plato discusses education in music. I think he said 90% of the child's education should be good music. It's just something very powerful. A child is attracted to good music. What a good way for the child to absorb their mind. And bad music, what a bad way for a child to absorb their mind. Music is in the modes. You get attracted to good music. And then what's the content? And when it's mantra, it's very, you know, powerful. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur even goes further beyond the mind and discusses music in terms of kind of an existential component of the soul. I don't have the references right here, but in the Rasa Leela, he discusses, you know, somehow species of life have melodies. Individual souls, even, said, have melodies. So there's something very inherently powerful so therefore special feelings of bliss. I mean, I gave five reasons, but just one reason is the hearing made easy by music. I'm going to have to actually go early today. I don't have that much more time. But the other reasons are also very nice. References for group petition being an individual petition. Group petition being better than individual petition, and shared lists being better than individual lists, and special mercy. There's references to the pleasure of God when he sees this activity. So, there's different reasons. I'm going to stop here. Are there any questions?
Maharaj?
Yeah, Mooney, I will.
Thanks. Even though you were discussing different things today, I felt like it all came together in a really powerful way. So thank you very much. It was inspiring.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't know. You said you have to go soon, so I don't know how much time you have. But
Go ahead. We'll see how it goes. Yeah, I don't have that much time, but yeah.
Well, you were talking about the need for context when we're trying to understand truth. I wanted to ask your opinion on something, but it might take a minute to give the background.
Okay.
So just let me know at any point if we should just shelve it. I'm happy to do that. But on a personal level and also professionally, one thing that I've been trying to think about a little bit lately is the claim that some people have that religion naturally leads towards social disruption and things like terrorism. It's not an uncommon charge by kind of the so-called new atheists and stuff like that. I think Christopher Hitchens said that religions, when they're taken to their fullest extent, they really long for death, and they long for some other world. Therefore, they totally devalue this world, and things like violence are okay because they're just about this world. So who cares? So I'll get to the question. Just one more. And so I've also been reading lately Edmund Burke, trying to think about why I am a conservative. And Edmund Burke had a pretty influential critique of the French Revolution, where he said that basically you had a bunch of people who were merely intellectuals at best, who had abstract ideas but didn't reflect deeply on the human ties amongst people and how to apply those ideas. And when you're devoted to an abstract idea, well, you don't mind so much destroying countless people because somehow the idea becomes a kind of idol in your mind. And so I guess what I wanted to ask you was, you know, this idea of context, do you see it as a corrective for these kind of problems? Or, I mean, do you, those two claims that I just uttered, how do you see them as being fixed? Like, because I think we have those kind of dangers in principle. Do you see this idea of really understanding things in context as a way to solve those problems, or do you think they're just separate issues entirely?
Well, I think there's, at least for Christopher Hitchens, I think there's a little bit of an intellectual dishonesty, you know? Because I think there's a core basis of human selfishness and human nature, you know, that goes beyond, that affects everything. So to discredit something because that appears there, I think is a little dishonest. And I don't think it's good scholarship. And I think a lot of modern, I've seen a lot of good intellectuals. I even saw something by the Dalai Lama, you know? It was in the New York Times. You know, they look at those type of atheists, you know, as just as fundamental, you know? And now in their thinking and prejudice as the, you know, modern whatever it is, you know?
Yeah, I I grant that, Marge. In fact, I think you're right.
Yeah.
And Hitchens, his book tends to be a bunch of rants. But I think you only have to look at things like revolution itself or the communist revolutions as good examples that you don't need religion to be a slaughtering zealot.
Yeah.
But all of that said, there seems to be a grain of truth that once you claim, as you noted in the beginning, well, we want to get away from the body and focus on the soul. Whatever.
Yeah.
There's a way in which it doesn't seem doesn't seem crazy to think that there's a way of devaluing the world which is dangerous, let's just say.
Yeah.
Or potentially dangerous. So I guess the question was about context. Like, the spiritual truths we have, and if we understand them in context, it may be a way of mollifying some of these. Anyway, that's what I was wondering about. I grant what you said about history.
I think unless you understand anything in context, you're not going to get a good understanding. And I think that's my point, And I think that's the criticism of religion. You know what I'm saying? When people don't understand it in the proper context, then the meaning gets lost. And that's the criticism of the people who criticize it, They don't see it in the proper context either. So I think contextual understanding is essential. If you want to, if there's some desire for some objectivity, if there's some objectivity, how can you not put it in context? And that's why the scholarly presentation is so satisfying, Like sometimes, in myself, if I'm not on, I'll give a lecture and there'll be, 100 interesting things said, But what's the context of each point that I spoke? And therefore, each point that I spoke has a lack of dynamicism because it's not energized and connected by a greater body of understanding. And I myself always try in lecture to put things in context, I think your point is right. Anything that you understand, if you really want to make a claim about something, understand the context in which it is said, and I think that's used by people to even persecute other people, take what they're doing, and therefore, the press or a government or anyone can malign anybody if they have access to their life, a politician, you just take one thing and you isolate it. And you take it out of context, and the person is being credited for saying or doing something else, than he's actually done, or things like that. I'm going to be crossing the road in a second. And are we connecting today, or did the point? I don't mind going there.
Are you asking do you want me to give you a minute to cross the road?
I'm waiting for the light to stop.
Okay. I think what you're saying.
Then I'll try to cross the road.
especially
at the West End Highway.
I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense, and it's funny because you had mentioned earlier our current culture of distraction, which I find myself to be a victim of personally. It's funny how the news nowadays is like a few sound bites with a little bit of. With a few statements, a few very, very simple contextual statements, and it seems like it's the overwhelming amount of information we have naturally leads us to have a very wide but extremely shallow base of knowledge.
Isn't it?
And it's unfortunate that it supports...
That's the problem with... that's the problem with politics,
Mm-hmm.
You get anybody, one side, the other side. Now I kind of got stuck again here. someone showing me the way was a more experienced New Yorker than me.
I have a follow-up. But should I give you a minute so you can think about what you're doing?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I don't know, to what degree then, you know, we as individual practitioners run into statements all the time that have been interpreted in various ways traditionally.
Yeah.
And they could be old statements. You know, like there's statements in the Vedas that we clearly don't accept, or we don't follow. And statements in the Upanishads. What to speak of the Manu Smriti and things like that. And then there's to what degree, and I think that, so, you know, this to what degree do we need to go through a similar kind of reflection with more recent statements? Let's say, for example, someone contextualizing certain things Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur did because he was engaging in a kind of protracted war with the Ramakrishna mission, or maybe it had something to do with colonial times or something, or Srila Prabhupada himself, things that he did maybe because of his circumstances. Do you think that's something which
is... there are things that do not correspond with one's own morality, intellectual understanding, if we have trust in our authority, then rather than reject it, we try to reconcile it. And, you know, if there's a greater body of truth that we've been blessed with and realized and saw, then those things that happen like that, if we're intelligent, rather than rejecting it, we try to understand how it's true. And indeed, some of the things may be, what is it? Context relevant, you know?
Yeah.
Some of the truths may be relevant in a particular context, and due to the, you know, our type of mind, we try to take those truths far beyond the context, but we also have to be open to the possibility that we ourselves, have our own prejudices that don't allow us to see the point. So I think it's a balance between the both. It's a great conversation. I'll probably have to go, and the reason is because as soon as I go into Raghunath's building, and I'm supposed to be there now, I'm going to lose reception, okay? So just a few people want to say hello. Thanks a lot.
All right.
Anybody else would like to say hello?
Krishna Maharaj.
Haribo, Nanda Dulao?
Yes, please accept my humble.
Oh, thank you. Great. Anybody else like to say hello?
Haribo Maharaj, please accept my humble obeisances.
Hare Krishna. Stella?
Yes, Haribo Maharaj. Will you be in New York next week for Atiyatra?
What's that?
Will you be in New York for Atiyatra?
No, I'm leaving on the 7th, and I return on the 22nd of June.
Oh, miss you.
I don't know everybody's schedule, but I would like to be there when you're there. Okay. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, your basis is.
Okay. Shastra, hi, Bo. I sent you a letter to forward to your Guru Maharaj. You get it?
No, I didn't. I'll look.
Oh, please look, because I sent him a letter, but I didn't know I sent it through you, okay?
Okay.
Okay. Anybody else like to say hello before I go into West Beth, the huge complex? Anybody else?
Hare Krishna, Maharaj. This is Gail.
Oh, Gail. Hare Krishna.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. Anybody else? A lot of people are listening to these classes. A lot of people download them. So, okay. And one more person?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, please accept my humble obeisances. Thank you for class.
Oh, thank you, Amya. Anybody else? Okay. Yeah. Thank you so much. Right? That's right. Got it. Wow. Anything else to say, Mo?